All right. We're ready. We're getting down to the last two sessions. I know I promised you it would be an 8-session course, but I thought, you know, let's make it a 10-session course. And, 12 puts us into the new year, and that's going to mess up my next plan. So we're going to do session 9 today and then session 10 next week. The following week is Advent 4, and between the services we have the greening of the church rather than Sunday school. And the Sunday following that, we typically take a break for Christmastide, and we return during Epiphanytide with a new subject, which I'll tell you about later. But we're going to finish Holy Habitations not today, but next week. Today we're going to talk about the current era, historicism and modernism. Session 9, we'll close with obviously a conclusion, wrapping up, and thoughts about application to our current setting next week. But first of all, we shall begin today. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, who has committed to thy holy church the care and nurture of thy people, enlighten with thy wisdom those who teach and those who learn, that rejoicing in the knowledge of thy truth, they may worship thee and serve thee from generation to generation, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. All right. Holy Habitations, session 9. I've been tending to begin each of these sessions with historical markers. And I've mentioned in this next slide several things that have happened historically. And I'm going to say, in general, we're talking about large movements of the people and sometimes movements of the positioning of the people within society, the masses, that would be. So we're dealing now not with emergence from the Reformation and the beginning of the Enlightenment. We're moving onward somewhat from the Revolutionary War, which, of course, is the movement of the people essentially beginning a revolution against the British, the royalty, the people against the rulers to establish their own country. That mentality is going on not only in America, but the French Revolution is happening around the same time. The Great Awakenings are in the same ballpark, a movement in which the religious experience of the people depends more upon the individual than it does upon the clergy or the theology that comes top-down. This is more of a bottom-up, grassroots kind of movement. The Industrial Revolution and the American Civil War, these aren't so much movements of the people and their perspective rising up, but nevertheless, they're pretty important for this period. Especially we'll find that the Industrial Revolution has people moving towards the cities and out of the countryside, moving away from agriculture and towards manufacturing. That's a big difference, and you'll see that manifest in church architecture before long. American Civil War, of course, is a major and traumatic event in the history of our country. But from the years of 1815 to 1930, 60 million European immigrants arrive in the United States. By 1930, the population of the United States is 130 million, I believe. And so for the roughly century before that, to have 60 million European immigrants, that's a massive movement of the people. That's a massive influx of European culture into the United States of America. Part of the reason this is why I have Lady Liberty on here. Of course, Lady Liberty was one of the first things that people would see when they came into this country, if they came across on boat. And there's something in that symbol there, that gift from the country of France, the United States of America, both of whom had gone through a revolution, that suggests something about the position of the masses to the hierarchy and the level, let's say, of power amongst the grassroots and the mass of population rises in these centuries that we're speaking of now, leading up to the present. Can't leave behind World Wars I and II, and it's far too much to contemplate. But they do come into play, and the effect of those wars manifests in the manner in which we treat the church, the manner in which clergy are viewed, theology is processed, and architecture is created, you know, is affected by those world wars. And the Second Vatican Council of the 1960s also is another movement of power, let's say, towards the laity, and the laity being raised up somewhat in that, in the Roman Catholic Church and the ethos there of Rome. And so all of these things, I'm going to say, are historical markers, but they essentially contribute to what we're saying next, that numerous historical events transpire over these most recent centuries, with the cumulative effect of placing more religious power into the hands of the laity, lessening the clerical divide, that is, the great distance between the clergy and the congregation, and leading churches to reflect on the past with a new set of values. You'll find there is something like in modernist architectural movements in the church, there is something like a new kind of architecture. But a lot of what happens in the following centuries has to do with what we'll call historicism, which is a manner of bringing the past into the present. We've already touched on it a little bit with the Gothic Revival. Here we have the juxtaposition of St. Patrick's in New York, which looks like it could have come out of the 12th century and been built at the same time as Notre Dame, you know, 800, 900 years ago, right next to a skyscraper and another skyscraper, you know. Obviously, this was built in the 19th century. This is not from the year 900 or the year 1200 or something like that. So there is clearly a calling back to history in the 19th century. Our author of Sacred Power, Sacred Space writes, since the beginning of the modern period, dated here to the late 18th century, perhaps the central issue shaping Christian architecture has been its relationship to the past. We began to touch on the Gothic Revival last week, and how we'll find, as with St. Patrick's there in, I think it's Manhattan, buildings that are constructed in the 19th century look like they could have come out of the 12th century. All right, what is that all about? It's a manner of relating to the past. In an era of increasing disintegration of society through revolution, industrialization, and criticism of the church. The 19th century is a real time of upheaval in the church and great criticism of the church. Many church builders believe that the revival of earlier approaches to church building, and especially the recreation of the Gothic parish church, would help stabilize and promote the church itself, so that when you walked into that building, it was almost like you were stepping back into a more stable time, a more stable era. And when your mind is reeling from the Revolutionary War and from industrialization and from the rise of really, you know, let's say atheism in the 19th century, and then you've got world wars and all that, wouldn't it be nice to just go back to the 12th century and just be there for a little while? Also, claiming connection to the past lends legitimacy to present activity. I do not criticize that statement. That is absolutely true. It's part of what we're doing in the continuing Anglican Church, is making sure that our feet are firmly planted on the bedrock of the early church, so that we know where we stand. But here's a church in Chicago, Holy Name Cathedral, built in the 1840s, 1850s. But obviously, these huge Gothic arches, a little bit of that medieval forest feel with the pillars, etc. And really, you get the sense that this could have been built long, long ago. Another element of historicism, as we're going to call it, immigrants tended to demand churches to stand as monuments of their own heritage. If you had come over and traumatically left your homeland of Ireland or left your homeland of Italy to look for a better life in the New World, what would you want your church to look like? You'd want your church to look like home, if you could. For instance, although Irish immigrant communities generally erected Gothic churches, and that's St. Patrick's, by the way, in downtown New York, carved into the stone are shamrocks and all kinds of references to home, which would be very comforting. For instance, although the Irish immigrants, erected Gothic churches, they frequently included traditional symbols such as shamrocks to tie the building to their homeland. But Italian immigrants also used architecture to make nationalistic statements, not Gothic, but neoclassical churches that alluded to their Roman heritage. And so here's St. Anthony of Padua, also in Manhattan, and you see these Roman arches, and you've got the what is that called? I can't think of it. But anyway, the reference to like the Pantheon, essentially, the Roman style pillars, all that makes a person feel in the 19th century a little more at home when they go to church on Sunday, alluding to the Roman heritage of the Italian immigrant. But not only are we pulling into the present time something of our experience from Europe, from you know whatever country the immigrants were coming from, those 60 million, revivalism of the 18th century is brought into the construction of churches in the 19th and 20th centuries too. We touched on that a little bit before, and we showed, I think last week, about how those revival services that were out in the field and in the camps outside the church in the 18th century began in the 19th century to find their way into architecture, these giant auditoriums that no longer had a high altar or a sanctuary per se, but the whole room was the sanctuary. And the congregations began to face themselves, face each other, so that we could witness the religious experience that each of us were having as a part of the service. So with an emphasis on the experience of the parishioner, rather than the sacramental act of the ordained, some congregations demanded to be physically closer to each other and physically closer to the clergy. And you find this in services like this, where it's very possible, like in our church, unless someone reaches out their hand to shake your hand, you'll never be touched by anyone. That's very English. Don't touch me. But it's possible that the person in front of you is going to pass out and fall backwards and throw their hands out, and you'll be one of the catchers in a more charismatic or Pentecostal type service. We're going to need to be close to each other. We're going to need to be able to move about. We're going to need to be able to fall down to be picked up again. We're going to need to be able to dance. We're going to be able to process and move around and all that. Space needs to be made for that, and so churches began to reflect that need. For some, though, the sacramental realm of the church then was discarded altogether to make space for a variety of more spontaneous religious experiences of the laity. We've got room for spontaneity in our church, but it's mostly if you have to go to the restroom, you can get up and go. You could even make the case from the New Testament that there is a weakness in a liturgical service like ours, that there isn't space, as St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, there isn't space for someone to come to speak in tongues. And if they were to speak in tongues, they should have an interpreter, and the interpreter should be edifying to all. That's a far cry from what we do in our services. You could say there's a weakness there, and I would accept it, except for that you can't have everything. So we... What's that?
No snakes.
Except on the blessing of the animals. You can bring your snakes then, but we don't do the snakes at St. George's. But I'm aware of the fact that there is truly in some of those churches a real benefit to the, let's call it, anti-formalism on some occasions. But generally, the accumulation of years upon years of anti-formalism leaves you formless altogether. And you don't know what's going on after a while. So that's my criticism. But so we turn then from historicism, this idea that we should be pulling from the past, from our the Gothic era, from the Basilica, from the Roman era, from our homeland of Europe or something like that, to a more modernist ideal. Some modern church architects and theologians rejected historicism as a form of atheism. The idea that God must be represented or experienced only in ancient or medieval forms, as if he does not exist in our own time. Their designs attempted to reflect the current era. So for some who were more of the modernist school, they'd walk into one of these great buildings that were constructed in Princeton in the 19th century and roll their eyes and say, "Oh, brother, this again. Gothic. What are we? What is this? The medieval church? This is the 19th, this is the 20th century. Let's get with the times." What does it mean for a church to get with the times in terms of architecture? Well, there's a question. So here's Canon Chapel in the Candler School of Theology in Atlanta, which is a part of Emory. So, and you notice that in their chapel, the church is wider than it is long. So it's longitudinal, but wide. So we've decided to completely toss out the idea of the procession and make it more like a gathering. That kind of thinking is really what we're talking about in terms of modernism. Basically tossing out the past and trying to reflect the current era. What these styles shared was a release from the past, an emphasis on the integrity of materials, a strong concern for function, and by the 20th century, a disinclination towards ornament. And I'm asking, is this related to the Industrial Revolution? And I'm going to say yes. So we have churches that look more like they were produced in a factory. And so when you go to a factory, what's the first thing you look at is the materials. Oh, look at these materials. Good, strong, stone. Good, strong brick. What does it do is a very Industrial Revolution type question to ask. What does this thing do? Oh, it doesn't do anything. It just sits there and it's beautiful. Ah, yuck. You don't want that. We want something that has a function. And we want it to remind us of the process of its creation, and maybe not so much the process as just the material itself. A disinclination towards ornament. And why in the world would that be? So this type of movement, I guess you could say, relates also in the Roman Catholic Church. They're not doing, by the turn of the 20th century, not doing so much of that modernist type thinking, but they are still tending to focus on the laity more in the 20th century. And so the Pope Pius X, by the early 20th century, Roman Catholics had retained the liturgical formalism. We're still in Latin, and we're still using that the Tridentine liturgy from the Council of Trent. But now we're starting to encourage more involvement of the laity. So one early form of that, Pope Pius X had encouraged Gregorian chant to be sung by the laity, not just by a cantor or the professional choir, and encouraged daily mass to be offered for lay people. You can compare that to the 15th century Roman Catholic Church, where you probably wouldn't receive but once a year, if you received once a year. Now, by the early 20th century, the Pope is encouraging you to go to daily mass. That's a new thing. And also, you're not just there to listen to the monks chant the Gregorian liturgy. You're to join in. We hear a little bit of that at St. George's. There's a call and response, which is Gregorian, actually, in its origin. By the 20th century, or in the 20th century, the role of the priest is also changing to become social activist, pastoral counselor, and regular guy. Okay? The medieval priest was not a regular guy, and he was not a social activist. Possibly you'd never meet your priest. It's possible. Now, if you read Pastoral Care by Gregory the Great in the 7th century, he is talking about pastoral care. But when you get into the late medieval era, I don't know that you would meet your priest, And, you know, some churches today, if you've got a church with 2,000 families, chances are you're not going to meet Father so-and-so. That's one of the benefits of Anglicanism, is it's typically small, more like family churches, and you generally, your priest notices if you're not there. But some of these movements are good, and I would say in the Roman Catholic Church, there's anyone listening to this is Roman Catholic will cringe, but the Roman Catholics are becoming more Anglican in the 20th century. And so the idea of involving the laity, and then eventually, let's do this in English, so that you don't come and just observe a service that you don't understand, but now you understand it, and you're asked to participate. Well, hey, we thought of that centuries before. And that's actually that's one of the original ideas of the church, so it's okay. But by the way, the SSPX is the Sacred Society of Society of St. Pius X. This emerges after Vatican II, and it is a movement in the Roman Catholic Church that wants to preserve the Latin Mass and wants to preserve sort of traditional Roman Catholicism. But that idea of preserving something historical in the church, yet including more participation, is not that different from what we're doing. But with modernism comes a theology, I'm going to say, of egalitarianism. Basically, that everyone is exactly the same. And it really depends on what you believe when you're considering this egalitarianism. This is a church designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And the building itself communicates something about the belief. So Frank Lloyd Wright, nephew of Unitarian Universalist minister, designed Unity Temple, Oak Park, Illinois, as an auditorium promoting egalitarianism amongst the assembled congregation that echoed Unitarianism's understanding of universal atonement. The building itself is communicating Unitarian Universalism. How is it doing that? Entry to the space required trespassing on the chancel. And so we're talking about this here. See, this is how you enter the room. You enter by trespassing on the chancel, which in the, you know, you know from our discussion of churches in the past, that was an area that you would process to from the back of the church, and you would approach when you were brought forward for communion, but you wouldn't enter the church from that area, right? But to enter the church from that area is a deliberate dissolving of the clerical lay divide and communicating we don't really believe in the priesthood, which they really don't believe in the priesthood, and the idea that all are saved is Unitarian Universalism. The building itself is communicating there really I suppose there may be some progress to be made in the Christian life, but probably the progress of the Unitarian is to realize that we're all universally saved and there's not much that has to be done. We just embrace each other. I've never been a Unitarian Universalist, so don't ask me to be a spokesman. I just know that's the general idea. But the building itself is communicating that. That's the point. The modern style, then, tends to be empty and spare, offering few cues to the Christian narrative. These modernist spaces rely heavily on the service itself to convey the required religious messages, but they also rely upon the inclinations of the individual to mentally fill in the meanings of the space, thereby fostering the empowering of the lay people who bear significant responsibility for their experience within these buildings. So here's Christ Church Lutheran in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And you can see that reliance upon the emphasis on the materials, because you see this these huge blank brick walls makes you think of not much but brick, right? The area at the front, the fact that it's oblong and a little bit off makes it feel as if the building was a part of something else. This was just the side building of a larger thing. Perhaps the larger thing is creation. And the cue there also is that the main feature of the front of the room, you would have to say, would be the light. And as the light comes in, it hits those rough bricks at the front, and you see the light changing. Okay, well, this is raw materials. This is nature. No longer are we looking to an ornate, peopled church with statuary and icons and all of that. All that stuff has been removed. So now the responsibility for the theological content is you and the clergyman and the service. But the church isn't communicating so much to you anymore. That's a modern style. Now, some would say that's like Thomas Merton was the one who said he thought it was an atheistic instinct to try and build a Gothic church in the 20th and 21st century, because it suggests that God isn't here in our current time. Well, if our current time looks like that, well, by that logic, you'd have to tear a building down every time there was a new era. You'd have to tear all the churches down and build all new ones to reflect the new era. Is that such a great idea? And it's a philosophical pondering. You don't need to come into Christ Church Lutheran and go, bleh. You can come into Christ Church Lutheran and say, oh boy, I've got to focus because this building's not going to do it for me. And when I pray, I'm going to close my eyes because there's nothing to look at. That's not a bad message. You know, it's okay. But if you say, I'd rather just be outside because I'm basically outside right now, you know, that doesn't sit quite right. You remember in one of our earlier classes, the association of pagan religion was with worshiping outside in nature, because you wind up worshiping the tree and the sun and the fish and the lake. So is it such a great thing for the building to communicate so little? That empty and spare style, there's a shocking phrase in here. This mystical use of space and light and the spare aesthetic of plain walls and simple furnishings well suited the growing emphasis on the power of the liturgy and on lay participation. This part, distracting images, stations of the cross, and chancel furnishings were eliminated. Just the idea that they would be called distracting. That would be crazy, but anyway, you can tell where the author's coming from. The author has called them distracting. So distracting images, stations of the cross, chancel furnishings were eliminated, leaving only the faithful, the celebrants, and the ceremony, paring down the setting into space, light, and material. Okay, and one thing you'd have to note, myself as a, let's say, historicist, traditionalist, a criticism is, when you've got so little communicated by the building, you're able to fill it with whatever you'd like to fill it with. So once you change the ceremony and change the message of the clergy or the celebrant, change the experience of the parishioner, the church can become whatever you want it to become. That's a weakness, I'm going to say, but I'm biased, so. And you also don't need to go into First Christian Church, Columbus, Indiana, and go, bleh. By the way, this church was designed by the same fellow that designed the previous one in Minneapolis. You just need to understand what this is. I see what they're doing. They've removed all of the symbols. They've removed all of the signposts, the guiding of the church towards God. And they've asked you to do it yourself. This may be a church where you might be more inclined to a contemplative experience, eyes closed, images gone type of prayer. That's not bad. That's not bad. Depends on what the actual manifestation of this becomes. Does the church actually become a more contemplative and orthodox church, or does it go off the rails and go crazy? I don't know. And is it the church, is it the building's fault? I don't know if it's the building's fault. The building is manifesting something. Yes, sir.
Okay, I can't help but notice, though, plants in there.
Mm-hmm. Right, you've got plants here.
There's no plants in a Gothic church.
That's true.
No flowers.
So what's been? Oh, I don't know about no flowers.
A bit of nature coming in. I mean, to break up the bomb shelter look. You know?
Right. Yeah. So for those who are just listening, we're looking at the image of First Christian Church in Columbus, Indiana. And it looks like a giant rectangle with just some holes in it so the light can come in. But they've also introduced some plants.
Yeah.
But the architect didn't introduce plants. The people did. The church did. And I wouldn't doubt that if there's somebody in the church said, can we have something in here? Like something live? Yes, Janet.
It strikes me, though, that it's one of the Danish modern homes, of course. It's very spare.
Right.
And that would fit with a lot of that part of the country.
Right. By the way, the architect is Scandinavian.
Having focused their eyes going across.
Right.
And in the previous one, the light might be across.
Right. So it's not all bad. It's just modern. So I think part of the reason that the historical architectural styles appeal to us so much is because we've come from this. Mm-hmm. And so when we've come from this and we get back into a church that has images again, we go, oh, they're back, you know. But the instinct here is not all bad. And like you say, this looks like the spare Scandinavian Danish style. Well, the architects, it's a father and son. You're not mistaken. There's an IKEA feel to the church. It's true. But we're going to turn from the modern style, and some of us call it it's an Art Nouveau, 20th century sort of. And you'll notice, like, even in if you go to the chapel at the Monastery of the Holy Spirit in Conyers, Georgia, it has sort of a mashup. There is a fantastic sort of, I'm going to say, Gothic style, but poured concrete structure. Yet the stained glass is relatively nondescript. It's more industrial feeling. The concreteness of it and the stained glass is just polygon shapes, you know, roughly the same color. You have something like a mishmash of ancient history and modernity at once. That's not all bad either, but it tends to ring now of the 50s. You know, you walk into a church and say, oh, 50s, 60s. Is that such a great thing? If you're going to hearken back to the past anyway, why don't you hearken back to the 13th century or like a real peak in the architectural history of the church? Why the 50s? So unless you're going to build churches to be scrapped and rebuilt every era, you're sort of planting a flag when you build a church. So anyhow, speaking of planting a flag, Mark.
Just a quick, sort of a non-committalness of this. Paving way to a sort of a globalistic religion.
Yeah.
These buildings not committing to any one religion.
Well, here's where we're going. We're going mega church now. So, yeah, there does seem to be, as you say, a stepping back from the theology of the church, a turn towards the more mystical experience, which is fine if the theology is straight. If the theology is straight, the mystical experience is wonderful. But if you remove the structure and the theology and now say, have a mystical experience, well, in 20 years, you'll be Buddhist. Because it can descend and slide in any direction you want it to descend and to slide into. And so that's one of the criticisms. It's not necessarily so. It just is potentially so. So, but now we're going to turn our attention to one final thing, the mega church, and what an Anglican theologian, Martin Thornton, would call multitudinism. In 1957, Billy Graham held revivals in Madison Square Garden, which was considered strange but wildly successful. And here's a picture of him in Madison Square Garden, cram-packed full. The church growth movement then was born, as evangelicals sought with vigor to grow their churches by multitudes of new conversions. There is, let's say, ain't nothing wrong with multitudes of new conversions. Bill Hybels succeeded in creating Willow Creek Community Church, which is the first of the mega churches. And how did he do it? Willow Creek Community Church, the first mega church. Well, one of the things he did was he took a survey. But he didn't take a survey of the church. He took a survey of the community and found out that people weren't going to church, and partly because they didn't understand it, and they didn't really get the symbols, and they didn't really understand what was going on here. So he said, got it. We're going to create a church where you don't have to understand anything. You just walk in, and you'll understand. Hybels embraced anti-formalism and anti-historicism as the functioning characteristics of Willow Creek. The new building would not look like a church. It would mimic the office buildings of the exurbs, and it would minimize visual references to religion. It was an auditorium, an asymmetrical polygon with fan seating focused on a thrust stage. There's the thrust stage, there's the fan seating, a complete emptying of all religious symbols and nothing like the churches before. And guess what? People loved it. Doing church for those who don't do church. Okay, this is a byword of Milestone Church in Guelph, Ontario, but I've seen it on billboards in Atlanta. Church for people who don't do church. Oftentimes, I'm going to also say, in the symbols for some of these churches, you can hardly tell that it's a church. And sometimes the word church is removed, and it's just a symbol that could be, you know, like Google, you know, or Yahoo, or that's old. What's a new one? I'm showing my... like Netflix or something like that, like an N. You know, no cross, no Christ, no church mention, just thing, okay? Another megachurch, Saddleback Church. This has been the largest of the megachurches, not the first, but the largest. Rick Warren is noted for the casual Hawaiian shirts he wears rather than the formal collar of the ordained. Nevertheless, he and other successful megachurch ministers delivering their messages from center stage and center screen in these impressive surroundings wield a great deal of charismatic authority. So you'd like to say that, boy, the power of the laity has risen, the power of the clergy has been reduced, the clerical-lay divide has been eliminated. See, he's wearing a Hawaiian shirt. On the other hand, he's got thousands and thousands of people gathering just to hear him. There's no sacrament offered. It's just Rick Warren. And so if Rick Warren isn't there today, why did I come to church, you know? So there's some unintended consequences of the megachurch. The bigger, better driven churches tend to embrace anti-formalism and anti-historicism of that megachurch model. And a lot of little churches, unfortunately, something like 80% of all churches in America are considered small churches. And when small churches idolize megachurches, they try to become a megachurch, and that's their only goal, is to be a megachurch. And to be bigger, better, bigger, better, bigger, better. And it's a real anxiety that resides in those smaller churches. Why aren't we 10 times the size? Anyway, unintended consequences of the megachurch. Here's Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California. And so you see there is light coming in from the side. You look out and you see, you know, trees and parking lot and all that. But you struggle to find a religious symbol anywhere. You struggle to find the building communicating to you something about God. It's basically an office space. You could say, well, then there's a mystical element of this that you can, close your eyes and ascend to God in a mystical experience. However, the message better be pretty good, because that's all you've got left is the message now. Frank, and then we'll move on. Typically the sermon and the music. The praise band would be stellar. They would be incredible. Well, not would be, they are. Incredible praise bands. So I went to, we'll get there in a second, North Point Church in Atlanta when I lived there, and that's Andy Stanley, Charles Stanley's son's church. And I went there on a youth night, 20 years ago, to see, what that was all about. There was 3,000 or 4,000 people there. And when the praise band came out, people cheered for them individually, like, lead singer of Bon Jovi or, Radiohead or something like that. Like, they were cheering for the individual artists of the praise band And it was indistinguishable from a rock concert. But that's really cool because it's free. And they're professional musicians. And then you got to listen to Andy Stanley give a sermon. But he's really good. So. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Christ is mentioned. It's not anti-Christian, but it's definitely anti-formalist and definitely anti-historical. And actually, Andy Stanley himself is famous for having said we should do away with the Old Testament. So once you've got a church that eliminates all references to history, it keeps going. And the man himself, the charismatic leader, says, why don't we just focus on the New Testament and do away with the Old? 76% of the canonical scriptures, by the way. And that was like, wait a second, you know, as we're doing away with the past, you know, hang on. So anyway, I'm going to get to the end of this before we're done here, but new historicism, possible postmodern mishmash, but there's some good too. Recently, a kind of new historicism has taken hold in schools of architecture, such as Notre Dame, and very significantly this week, Notre Dame was reopened after the fire. And I bet you, dollars to donuts, that will inspire some young architects to say, why can't we do this again? Why can't we return to this? Because you know the awe that people have when they walk into that building. They say, boy, there's really something here. This is an 800, 900-year-old building. It's been refurbished, as the head of the reconstruction said, for another 800 or 900 years. Stronger now, with fire suppression system built in. So, encourages again a return to classicism, like a Gothic revival. But others are trying to mix together these movements. Other schools of thought have attempted to blend the flexibility of modern architecture with references to ancient tradition, and the results are mixed. So here's Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. And what do you find here? But you find Gothic arches. And if you can see sort of in this facade here, there's more Gothic arches. You find something like a Gothic spire, a steeple, but yet not. And it still has this sort of a megachurch setup. The interior of Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie has the church in the round. It has the pulpit put forward, like the thrust stage. And the choir from behind. Gone is the high altar. There's a table down here. There's the plants again. As you mentioned, you know, bring some greenery into this room. But yet, there on the outside, on the facade, there's something like a callback. Now, is that a development, or is that a good thing, or is that a mishmash? It's up to you to decide. Nevertheless, that's where we're at. You would never see a building like that built in the 17th century. They would never have had the context to build something like that. But in the 20th century, in the 21st century, you could see a building like that built. Because now we have all of these things to draw from, and we just say, well, what if we put them all together? What does it look like? You put them all together, it looks like that. And you can decide for yourself whether you think it's good or bad. And these are, yes, please, Larissa.
So with the rise of the megachurch, or whatever, yeah, super church, or whatever, mm-hmm, like, I know there's probably discussion bodies and whatnot. Has it ever been any self-reflection? Because I think possibly some of the revolt to that completely, there's nothing in it that looks like a church,
right,
is because there was a lack of understanding as to what the purpose of all of these things,
right,
were. Because it used to be, that was like straight up education.
Right.
Anyone younger, like, than me, is going to walk into, like, even a place like this,
yeah,
like, what's happening?
Right.
And it's almost like imperative for the people trying to maintain whatever that message is, to explain their message and not just assume that everybody gets this message. Because otherwise, you know, there's a mega church and we're like, nobody understands this anyway. And
right,
nobody wants to be there because nobody understands it and it's weird.
So for those,
you know what I mean? It's like self-reflection to be like, maybe it's almost not our fault, but like the old ways fault.
Right.
The mega church and lack of anything had arisen.
So for those who are listening online, because I've been recording right here, they may not have heard your question. The comment is basically, we seem to see poles, like a polarity here. On the one side, we've gone completely anti-formalist, anti-historical megachurch model. And there's a successful megachurch, that's too dark here, but successful megachurches have thousands and thousands, and wannabe megachurches are very stressful 100 people who are trying desperately to become the megachurch. And they don't want anything formalistic or historical. But the reaction to that is happening right now, where people are leaving those churches and either leaving the church altogether, or they're searching for something historical. So the reaction is happening as we speak. As an Anglican, what's that? That's for people to decide for themselves. But here's the question: should a church be flatly obvious to people who walk in, or should there be an element of it that's not immediately understood? And part of our movement is that it should not be immediately all understood as soon as you walk in, because that's the mall. You understand the mall when you walk in. There's the food court, there's the store, there's the parking lot. You walk into a church and it's like, there's so many questions. I have so many questions, but I know there's something good here. Perhaps it's worth staying and having these questions answered. We are running out of time, but yes, Joe.
Well, I think too, it's, you walk into a place like this and you're surrounded by tradition and history and what
right.
You've done, the richness is there, whereas I've been in a megachurch where you walk in before the service and everything's dark. It is literally
yeah.
Dark.
Yeah. It's meant to be like a auditorium, like a yeah. Studio or
and
something.
You're focused on what's happening on that podium or the,
right.
That stage, and so that's what you're stimulated
right.
By.
It's theater.
And so
yeah.
What happens after that? And that person that's up there is the focal point.
Yes,
and
very
that
much.
That person has clay feet like all of us.
Right.
Like Bill Hybels and Brooke.
Yeah.
You have problems later on where they get that dissonance.
Yeah, there are unintended consequences to any movement, and the one unintended consequence is when you put all the focus on someone like Bill Hybels. Bill Hybels better be perfect. Because if Bill Hybels stumbles, thousands of people will say, well, that's how I know the Lord is through Bill Hybels. And so if Bill Hybels has feet of clay, I give up. That's danger. That's danger. Anyway, this has got to be the last comment, Allison.
Well, I was just thinking also with the modernism and like the mega churches. I think it's more of an escape also to get away
right.
From your own epistemological self-consciousness that we are sinners.
Right.
And that, like you said, they want to get rid of the Old Testament.
Right.
So that's getting rid of the law.
Yeah, yeah.
So you want to just get rid of all that. And I saw that with the Unitarian Church. I saw the flags
right.
On there.
Keeps going.
Getting away from the law.
That's right, yeah.
So a lot of people want to go back to the law because
right.
Getting rid of it, you have chaos.
Yeah.
So,
bunch more could be said, but we got 10 minutes. We got to go. All right. Thank you.